Good evening, welcome to Behind the News for April 29, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got a jam-packed show tonight, so I'm going to dispense with the economic headlines, except to note a couple of things in about 15 seconds. About three segments, we're going to talk to Sean Jacobs, who's one of the organizers of a film festival celebrating 10 years of freedom in South Africa. We'll talk to him about that film festival and also the recent elections. And then about 20 after, we'll speak with Richard Burkholder of the Gallup organization, who is the supervisor of that of Gallup's poll of Iraq. We had him on last fall when he talked about a poll they did of Baghdad and new attitudes revealed in the latest poll, which are much, much more hostile to the United States. We will talk about that with Richard Burkholder in about 20 minutes. And then finally, Amy Liu, who is the author of a novel called Flash House. And we'll talk about politics and intrigue in Asia in the late 1940s, continuing to today, and maybe a bit also about sexual trafficking. So heavy mixture of politics and culture tonight. Two items I just wanted to talk about in the economic news. First of all, U.S. economic growth, GDP growth, came in a little under expectations for the first quarter of this year. Strong, but not as strong as people had expected. Wall Street worried about rising inflation. I'll have more to talk about this area next week. A little anxiety about return to the 1970s stagflation. Is that anything to worry about? But we'll return to this topic next week. The other item is that Chinese authorities have instructed bankers to take a week off and stop making loans, worried about the overheating of the Chinese economy. This is gives new meaning to the term bank holiday, and it just seems that China, which has been booming like nothing, almost nothing in economic history for the last close to 20 years, is giving signs of being in some kind of blow-off phase. So we have to wonder if the Chinese juggernaut is about to pop a wheel or something. I don't think that means, you know, the end of the Chinese miracle or anything like that, but we shall see if China is about to experience its own little accident on the way to greater prosperity. We shall see. Also, we'll return to that topic next week, but very interesting development of the Chinese authorities telling bankers to stop making loans. Very unusual business. And now we're joined in the studio by Sean Jacobs, who teaches at NYU and is with the documentary campaign and one of the organizers of a film festival, whose name escapes me, 10 years?
10 years of freedom.
10 years of freedom. So tell us about the Fust Festival, Sean.
Well, as you know, as listeners know, South Africa is 10 years old. South African democracy is 10 years old this April. In South Africa, there's a lot of celebration, of course. And we can talk about the nature of that celebration on how people, you know, feel about it. But here in New York, in the United States, the government is doing, you know, one or two events. And we felt the best way for Americans and us to reflect on that 10 years is to do it through film. That's a very accessible means. And using a wide variety of genre, documentary to shorts to feature, fiction features. We're showing 43 films for 1 week at the Clearview Cinema, 62nd and Broadway in Manhattan, and it's until Sunday, May 2nd.
Now, has there been an explosion of film in South Africa? Is this are you picking from rich crop here?
South Africa is an interesting country for film. Like under apartheid, there was a film industry, an autonomous film industry, almost like a studio system, in which films were made for commercial distribution, particularly among the white population. They made, you know, like westerns, if you want, and love dramas, you know, these sort of copying Hollywood. In the 1960s, they made sort of propaganda films, both for South Africa and for the outside world, to show them, look, you know, it's not as bad as you think it might be. Black people specifically only started appearing in cinema in the 1950s, and the first proper film, if you want, with black people playing a meaningful role in it, only happened in 1959. It was made by a New Yorker, by the way, Lionel Rogerson, who made a film called Come Back Africa. And then only much later in 1987 came only probably the second movie where South Africans played like a decisive role in how that script was written, what story had been told. It was called Mapantsula. In between, of course, there was Cry Freedom, Dry White Season, and all these American-made movies about South Africa. So after Mandela was released, censorship went, leading up to the 94 election, the film industry, of course, boomed. And especially documentary came back in a big way. Feature films, there not a lot of feature films in South Africa yet, but people are making a lot of shorts. Of course, outsiders, you know, coming to South Africa, they shoot ads because South Africa, some parts of South Africa, serves as a sort of cheaper, like a backdrop, but a cheaper way to shoot an ad, a European ad or North American ad. So the South African film industry at the moment, I think, is more like a mixed bag rather than it, you know, got rid completely from the sort of the way that the apartheid cinema worked under apartheid.
Edna, there's a benefit tonight at 6 o'clock at the Clearview 62nd and Broadway. Of course, we don't have much time till 6 o'clock, but anybody...
Well, if people can still rush over there, yeah. It's in aid of the Treatment Action Campaign, which is an activist group based in South Africa fighting for cheaper drugs and for the government to start some form of treatment plan, as well as you know, a much more active prevention plan for people living with HIV/AIDS, and also, as I said, to try and keep the rate of infection down in South Africa. The government, as you know, has been very their response to the AIDS crisis hasn't been as critical as one would have expected. So TAC has taken the lead on that, and tonight's benefit is to raise money for TAC, for the Treatment Action Campaign, and its activists, who basically most of them are volunteers in South Africa. And hopefully, you know, tickets are $20. It's a good cause, so I hope people are going to come out and support us.
And what do they get for their movie for their $20?
For their $20, they get to see two short movies. One is called A Red Ribbon Around My House, which is about a woman in Soweto who got HIV through a blood transfusion and is open about it, goes around the community, talks to people about living with HIV/AIDS, and... She's rather interesting character. She dresses like Grace Jones. And so her daughter, who is this really conservative young woman, you know, born-again Christian, if you want, has major problems with her mother coming out and telling everyone that she's HIV positive. So the film follows that 30 minutes long. And then the real excitement is there's about a 48-minute episode from a television series that is the most popular television series in South Africa. It has the kind of cult status that The Sopranos has with some people. It's called Yizo Yizo. It's about young people living in Johannesburg in South Africa, and the third series just started, and the episode we're showing is about has an AIDS theme. And one last thing about the benefit, what they're getting is Gloria Rubin. I don't know how well known she is among...
From ER, right?
Right, from ER. She's going to be hosting the evening and introducing the films.
And what else we got coming up in the next few days?
We have tomorrow again, as you know, 1 o'clock. We have shows at 1 o'clock and 4 o'clock. Those shows, by the way, for any member of the public that turns up, you know, it's a free screening at the theater. We have a 6 o'clock screening tomorrow night again. The movies to look out for tomorrow night is a movie called Guguletu 7, which is about the killing of six activists, members of the ANC in 1986, a cover up by the police. And the eventual exposure, you know, it was exposed in front of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's one of the cases where the TRC did do something, you know, more than just truth and reconciling people, and kind of went beyond the sort of, if you want, the slogans. Over the weekend, there's also we have a sort of May Day with some movies that deals, you know, of course we celebrate May Day in South Africa, May 1st.
In America, we celebrate Law Day and Loyalty Day on May 1st.
Is that what it's
yes.
called?
Well,
yeah,
well
on
it's two holidays.
We have a workers' program. We have interesting movies that I would, you know, tell people. I mean, the whole program's interesting, but over the weekend, the movies I think that are really interesting is this one movie called Letter to My Cousin in China. A lot of people don't know that South Africa has a small Chinese community that had been there since the Gold Rush, sort of sandwiched in between the black and white, you know, in that whole struggle between black and white. And sometimes they were black, sometimes they were white. The Japanese, of course, sometimes were honorary white, depending on the policy of their government towards the apartheid government. And this is a very sweet film about a man who is trying to come to terms with the fact that his father came to South Africa, and whether he's now South African or whether he's Chinese, and follows him back to China, back to the United States, where his father came to live. And then it sort of works itself out during the film. Cinderella from the Cape Flats, and maybe it's the last one I'll punt. It's a movie about in the factories in Cape Town, the workers who belong to the trade union movement, every year they have their own sort of Miss World competition in their own factory. And one of these films follows one of these clothing workers around while she's preparing for this competition. So very sweet. There's sweet movies. Of course, there's movies that challenge, you know, some of the South Africa, of course, you know, the rainbow myth, this idea of people coming together, living in one country. And there are movies that go beyond that. There's a movie called Between Joyce and Remembrance, which is when a killer goes to ask forgiveness of a family, and the family says, well, we're not so sure, and we think you're too late. And what happens in that movie, I mean, is very unexpected. You know, what people don't really expect from when they usually hear about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
I'm speaking with Sean Jacobs, who is one of the organizers of a festival put together by the documentary campaign, 10 Years of Freedom in South Africa. And people want to check out, there's a website for the
festival. There's a website, www.10yearsoffreedom.org. The schedule, if you...
10 is spelled out as a word.
10 is spelled out as a word. If you look at the top of the screen, click on schedule and it will come up. You can also call 777-FILM. And there is an access code which now escapes me, but you should be able to go through the Clearview Cinema and the movie listings will come up.
Okay, and let's switch gears and get more political for a moment. There was an election, almost 2 weeks ago?
April the 14th, yeah.
The turnout was enormous, 75%, and the ANC got almost 70% of the votes. There are some people on the left in South Africa and abroad who criticize the ANC as a bunch of sellouts and betrayers doing the business of the IMF and the World Bank and all that. What's your analysis of that? How do you react to that kind of indictment?
I mean, I think at one level it is true that the ANC has moved to the right economically. A lot of it is, you know, the context in which the ANC operates. There's structural factors. There are the IMF and the World Bank. It's not just South Africa that's been subjected to austerity measures that are, you know, cut your social spending, cut your budget. You can only spend this much. I mean, most other countries are in the grip of this kind of, if you still want to call it the Washington consensus. Secondly, of course, South Africa has a small white minority that is very powerful still. And any sort of any government in South Africa that does major redistribution, major overhaul of the society can expect some white, white flight, capital flight. People will leave.
And a number of major South African corporations have
they
literally
have left. They
left,
moved to London, but with the consent, by the way, of the government, which is when people make that criticism, I think sometimes it's criticism that's valid because the South African government made that happen. They allowed those corporations to leave and go to London. SAB Miller that bought up Miller here in the United States, Anglo American, De Beers, Old Mutual, which is a huge life insurance company. I don't know how that's what life insurance is called in the United States.
Life insurance. Yeah.
So the South African government did sometimes, I think, facilitate it, and that's where some of the criticism comes from. So at some level, yes, the government has moved to the right, but at another level, what the critics sometimes forget is people had struggled under the banner of the African National Congress for about 80 years, you know, whether that ANC slowly moved to become a mass movement, moved to become radical. The truth is that's the movement in which people have invested emotionally, in which they've invested their lives, their votes. And not everyone, of course, who's in government is, you know, a nasty human being who just wants to beat up on the poor. These people who are in government, their families are often living in the townships. They're poor too. It's kind of my personal sense, and you know, of course, I've historically voted for the ANC, like most, sometimes even these leftist critics, most of them, if they go out and they vote, if they don't spoil their vote, they vote for the ANC. The best example I can give about the conundrum, if you want, the difficulty of how this is playing out in South Africa, because the people who criticize and I think dismiss the ANC, even though they're an important voice, it's still very much a marginal voice. But there are other groups were operating at a sort of more ambiguous level. The Treatment Action Campaign, for example, is one example. This is a group that is very critical of the government's policy on health, you know, the government, the public health system's failure to protect, you know, people, and secondly, specifically on AIDS. The last, when the election happened and now the president has announced a new cabinet, he reappointed the Minister of Health, the one that they had a problem with. Yet they congratulated the ANC in their statement, and they said, you know, we are sad about you putting the same health minister there, but he had appointed a deputy health minister, which is sort of pro them, so they welcome that. Secondly, they welcomed a number of other appointments of people who are progressive in that cabinet. You know, so there's I suppose, a sort of push and pull, and people are having a much harder time moving away from saying, well, I've supported the ANC for such a long time. How do I shift? And I'll you know, stop after this. In Zimbabwe, that's a very good example of how this happens. ZANU is corrupt, you know. There are major problems in Zimbabwe about land, etc. There's inequality. But the way that ZANU has governed in Zimbabwe has made a lot of people doubt ZANU. The problem is, that was your organization. You lived with it. You know, it's almost like a church. So to break away from it and go join another party, that's a long process. And it took about 20 years in Zimbabwe for that to happen. So I'm saying the leftist critics, you know, they have a voice in South Africa, very loud.
But where can they go?
The problem for them at the moment is the ANC has almost, the ANC holds kind of like sway, you know, it controls like working class vote of that. I mean, as you pointed out, 75% of the people turn out to vote. 70% of them gave their vote to the ANC. The second largest party was 12%, composed mostly of white South Africans. They had a sort of knee-jerk right-wing campaign. So the leftists at the moment, what they sort of waiting for is a kind of break in the ANC. They would love to see a break in the ANC with the ANC's trade union allies leave, because they have, that's probably where that break can take place. And if you, the second part of where they go, I think, is into what, you know, usually is called civil society. I think they end up becoming pressure groups, fighting evictions, fighting electricity hikes and privatization of electricity, fighting the privatization of water. So they're not in parliament, but they operate on that sort of, as a sort of pressure group on the side. And strangely, I mean, despite, I think, sometimes harsh criticism by some people in the ANC often gives them an ear. I think often when the ANC, the relationship at this point is also so strained that when the ANC responds to them, then they go, you know, it's too late now, or you know, why are you responding now? So it's not difficult. But I suppose they're moving into what you would call civil society.
All right, well, that's it. Thanks for joining us, Sean Jacobs. You've got to get up to the benefit, which is at the Clearview, 62nd and Broadway, and for the next several days, the 10 Years of Freedom Film Festival at the Clearview, 62nd and Broadway. And thanks for joining us, and good luck with the rest of the festival.
Thank you very much, Doug.
I've been speaking with Sean Jacobs, who is with the Documentary Campaign and one of the organizers of the 10 Years of Freedom Film Festival, celebrating 10 years of freedom in South Africa. And this is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, and we'll move along without any kind of musical interlude because it's got a full plate here tonight. We're joined now on the line by Richard Burkholder, who directs international operations for the Gallup organization and supervised a poll Gallup just did in partnership with, I believe, CNN and a newspaper whose name escapes me. They polled the people of Iraq to find out what they're thinking these days. We had Burkholder on last fall to talk about a poll they'd done of Baghdad, but now they've polled pretty much the entire country. Welcome to WBAI, Richard Burkholder.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me back.
And thanks for joining us. I'm sure you're busy with this poll just being released.
It's not been a quiet day, but it's what we live for. So.
Right. And the poll was co-sponsored by CNN and
USA Today.
USA Today.
And by the way, grab a copy of today's USA Today, because there's a wonderful write-up internally about how it was done. on page four of that about the difficulties in doing it. So I recommend that.
Yeah. Now, when I've talked about, I got actually quite a few hostile communications when I had you on last fall for people who said, you know, how can you dare pull people under occupation as a dishonest propaganda campaign, et cetera, even though we'd spent quite a bit of time talking about just how you'd done the polling. And I think we need to start with that again. This is a very serious and complicated operation you've undertaken.
You bet. Well, trust me, they were pretty free with their opinions last summer, and they're just as free with them now, and they're more negative now than they were last summer if you just look at the Baghdad subsection of this. We've still done Baghdad over again and can look at that against the attitudes in last August and very early September. But cooperation, you know, if the questionnaire, if it comes across as an enterprise of Iraqis by Iraqis about their hopes and their aspirations, and if it's a balanced questionnaire, and the interviewers are all Iraqis and know the neighborhoods, there's not a problem with cooperation on this. So we had only 2% of the people that were, for one reason or another, not willing to cooperate.
Yeah, let's underline that. You had a 98% cooperation rate, which contrasts with what, like 27% in American polls these days?
Yeah, exactly. It depends if they're run by telephone and especially marketing calls and so on. Yeah, they can drop way, way down. That's not, I mean, that's extremely high, but I've done other work in places where there isn't a huge history of polling, in which, particularly in rural areas, the cooperation rate is very, very good. If you explain what it's about and why you're asking, and if you start with a questionnaire that meets, you know, what are your hopes, what are your dreams, what do you want for your children, what's important to you, and they get a sense that there aren't right or wrong answers to any of this. I mean, the bigger problem, frankly, we had in a lot of these places is other neighbors coming to the house once they hear that you're in a neighborhood saying, we'd like to be interviewed too. We'd like to talk about what's important, what we've been through. We think people should know. So that's not, I mean, people talk politics and people talk about it all the time. And in this system, they know that the old regime's gone. But they're plenty critical this time in a lot of areas.
But as I recall, you said last fall, you got the feeling that some folks hadn't been asked their opinion in decades, maybe their entire lives. So they were very excited that somebody was interested
absolutely.
In what they thought.
That's absolutely the sense that people do talk about stuff. But again, it's a question of what's your motive? What's the purpose of this? You have Iraqi people doing this. The questionnaire is balanced. And a lot of the questions are open-ended in your own words, this and that. You'll have to. The only thing I can say is, I mean, people are right to be skeptical generally, but look at the substance of the results. They gave credit where credit was due. They gave criticism where criticism was due. Where the criticism's increased, I think you can argue objectively it's warranted to a large degree. So I don't have a problem with the and the open ends that you get, the verbatim responses. Are certainly not anything that would be orchestrated or fed into them. I mean, they're pretty specific.
Before we get to the specific contents of the of Rocky's opinions, one more methodological question. The sponsorship of this was disguised. People didn't know this was for an American
poet. Oh, no, that's exactly right. The Pan-Arab Research Center is the group that helped supervise this stuff, and of course we're involved too, but we don't say it's for, you know, especially now we're in the position of, if there was any connection, obvious connection to an American company or an American polling outfit, if that were obvious, absolutely hamper getting free and candid opinions. No, it had to come across, and it did come across, and it was a poll of Iraqis by Iraqis about their future. You know, I mean, we pretested the questionnaire for weeks to make sure that it would, the people understood the questions and fed their feedback from the interviewers and from the pretest things until they had a better interviewing instrument. But, I don't know how to say this. Gallup's been doing this for about 70 years and about 50 years overseas, and it's really a case of having good local people to work with and good people from the region to work with who also respect those values and trying to get a clean, honest measurement. And as I said, the interviews are almost 70 minutes long, and there's plenty in there that's pretty candid and forthright.
All right, now let's get to what you found. This much of what you found is not going to be regarded with comfort by Paul Bremer or Donald Rumsfeld, is it?
No, you know, I think they're. If you want to say in a word, they're disillusioned and disappointed. They had higher expectations for our ability to accomplish what we said we were going to accomplish in the short term. So lots of things have soured in the past year. If you look at the attitude towards the troops and how they conduct themselves, in Baghdad last August and September, we found by a 2-to-1 margin, they were saying generally we think the troops have conducted themselves fairly well. Now that's shifted entirely. It's like 8-1 negative just in Baghdad. We don't have a trend for the rest of the country, but it's also predominantly negative. We've been there for a year. The security situation isn't under control. They haven't had elections. They don't have an elected government to hand over power to, and they're aware of all of those things. So best intentions or not aside, depending on your politics, the fact is that the proof is in the pudding, as you say. So and they're frustrated with that. Now, they think things are going to get better 5 years from now. If you ask them 5 years from now, will the country be better off? Overwhelmingly, they say yes. Their optimism, long-term, medium-term, is really quite remarkable, but not at this point on our watch. And, of course, our watch supposedly ends in 2 months, right?
Yes, although it's not quite clear whose watch it will become after that.
Exactly.
Your poll last fall of the people of Baghdad still found a considerable skepticism about U.S. motives. There was quite a strong support for the idea that we were there for the oil and not for democracy. What do people think of our motives now?
Well, we didn't ask the motive for the invasion question now because I think we got a pretty good, clean read on it. But where there's skepticism is in the depth of the U.S. commitment to establishing a democracy or to rebuilding the economy and all of these things. We found only about a third or slightly more than a third of people agreed with the statement that the U.S. is really serious about bringing a democratic system or that the U.S. is going to allow Iraqis to define their future without interference from us. They've looked at let me give you the exact numbers. U.S. is very seriously about establishing a democracy. 37% agree, 50% disagree. U.S. will allow Iraqis to design their own future as they see fit without U.S. interference. 28% agree, 57% disagree. U.S. is very serious about improving the economic lot of Iraqis. 37% agree, 54% disagree, and so on. There's been 7 months through. There hasn't been elections. There was a talk about a caucus system, which Sistani argued was not really as representative as it should have been. Now the best hope for elections is next winter sometime. And so we will be handing over power on June 30th to some transition interim government that will not have been elected, and they're aware of all of that, obviously.
And as Bush said in his press conference a couple of weeks ago when asked who will he be handing over power to, he said, you'll find out.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's been cooking for a while. Now, Brahimi's plan, Lakhdar Brahimi, the special envoy from the UN, has been talking about a limited caretaker government. What had been mooted for a while was either the current Iraqi government council or some expanded version of the Iraqi government council, which, remember, was initially appointed by the coalition authority. We actually tested, it's interesting, very, very kind of prophetically, we said, would you prefer power be handed over if there aren't elections by June 30? Would you like to see power handed over to the current IGC, to an expanded IGC, or to a limited caretaker government whose main responsibility would just be to hold elections? And overwhelmingly, they chose the third option.
So Iraqis really do want to elect their own leaders.
Exactly. It's a question of legitimacy and having some sense of authority in place. So it doesn't matter, if you've invited the right number of Shias or the right number of Sunnis or the right number of Kurds into that mix. That's not what they're interested in. They're interested in some kind of accountability to the public.
I'm speaking with Richard Burkholder, who is the director of Gallup's international operations and supervised Gallup's poll of the people of Iraq. This is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM on the radio dial and WBAI.org on the web. You also found considerable variation by religious affiliation and ethnic group. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, let me give you a couple of examples. It really cuts... cuts across a couple of the key issues. There's a question about whether or not people think it was worth it to have. Was everything you've gone through since the invasion worth it? And we get a much higher response that it was worth it among the Shia population in the country than among those in predominantly Sunni areas. Similarly, the percentage of people who say that attacks on U.S. forces are completely justified. Just from 8% in the predominantly Shia South, in Basra and Nasiriyah in that area, to 30% in those areas that are mostly Sunni, to as high as 62% in the provinces of Anbar and Salatin, which is where Anbar includes Fallujah and Ramadi and so on. So it really is not just one landscape. And the one huge, huge outlier in all of the sentiment is the Kurdish population in the north, especially in those areas that have been effectively self-governing for a decade or more, who may as well, they're just night and day to the rest of the population, wildly sympathetic to the coalition, wildly sympathetic to the objectives, very pro-American, And it's only 13% of the population and of our sample, but they look very different from the rest of Iraq.
Now, when you add up all the numbers, it's doing this arithmetic, and I hope they got it right, but it looks like 52% of the population says that attacks on U.S. forces are justified, at least in some circumstances.
Right. It's ranging a 5. From some... That's right, the math.
Yeah.
At least in some circumstances, they're justified.
So that's a pretty strong number.
Yeah, and in fact, it's as again, we have a trend on that from Baghdad. I think we had about 18 or 19%. They said they're mostly somewhat justified or completely justified last summer. The two higher points on the 5-point scale, and that's doubled. So it's
in Baghdad.
In Baghdad, just in Baghdad. That's where we have the trend. And I would argue, as you would, that the people in the middling are saying sometimes they are and sometimes they're not. Is also a problematic group. We also ask if attacks on Iraqi police are justified, and there you get virtually no one saying that. I mean, it's in the single digits that say they're either somewhat or completely justified. So it's not a question of being opposed to of simply Ba'athist loyalties or wanting the old regime back. It's literally a question of occupying forces at this point in their sentiment.
Now, some people have been saying that the U.S. occupation succeeded in uniting Iraqis in ways that couldn't have been accomplished before. Is there any evidence for that?
Well, I still see shifts across Shia and Sunni opinion. I think that's probably, to some extent, it's probably overstated. I think what you hear reports of tactical coalition among insurgents and so on, but that wouldn't affect the aggregate numbers. I think that right now, both Sunni and Shia, predominantly areas, are more likely to see American forces as occupiers than liberators, and that would have been that's certainly different than would have been the case last. If you look at the areas that were predominantly Shiite in Baghdad last summer, ironically, Sadr City, which had been called Saddam City, which is the huge Shiite slum which was brutalized by Saddam, was the most sympathetic to the coalition, the most supportive of the invasion, and now it's split. So I don't know that it's united in some sense, but certainly there's been some coalescing of opinion across the two.
Now, did you get any sense of why the British have been doing a little better in around Basra?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The image of Britain across Iraq is as negative as the image of the U.S. in the aggregate. Why had they been doing better militarily in the south? Partly that has to do with, as I said, a more sympathetic area. We have only 8%. Which, you know, this is, again, an area that was very much disadvantaged under the prior regime, really, again, brutalized. Secondly, the approach taken by their troops has been what the Brits call a softly approach. There's been much more of an attempt to interact with the communities. Now, I would have to say that those areas are not as objectively dangerous as Ramadi or Fallujah or Baqaba or some of these other places. But nevertheless, they are more experienced in kind of contact between military forces and civilian population, something that was learned the hard way through experience in Northern Ireland. And they will tell you, if you pull British commanders aside, that they're far more adept at that kind of situation. But in fairness, I think they're also in a less hostile environment.
There also have been some reports in the British press, which I don't know if made over here, but some British commanders have been very critical of the way the Americans have been doing their jobs. Too brutal, too arrogant.
I've seen some of those that reporting on the BBC as well. Yeah.
And now let's see. What about the opinions of the Coalition Provisional Authority and Paul Bremer? What do people think of that gang?
Well, Bremer is still his rating, his popularity rating is significantly higher than President Bush's, but it's not what it was. And again, I'm trending across Baghdad, not what it was last summer. So, you know, it's sort of in rank order. It would be Bush at the lowest level, U.S. slightly above that, coalition slightly above that, and Bremer slightly higher still. It's really a performance thing. I mean, I think the telling number is, and it really gets to the heart of the disillusionment, you know, have the CPA's actions worked out better than you initially expected at the time of the invasion, or worse than you initially expected? And by better than 2-1, people say worse than I initially expected.
Why do they have expectations at all? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, you know, we pronounced that's a good question. I mean, we pronounced that we were trying to stabilize the face, to get rid of a bad regime, to bring democracy, to reconstruct the economy. All of those things are stated objectives of the policy. And I think there's this sense of omnipotence in the U.S. that if we can shove armies aside, why can't the power work? Why can't the situation be secure? Why can't they stop crime? Why can't we stop bombing attacks? All of these things. So, you know, why were the expectations high to begin with? I think the people who were proponents of this loudly pronounced that this was going to be an example for the region of a society that had been brutalized that could be made into a peaceful, harmonious, sectarian, non-sectarian democracy, and we're a ways from achieving that yet. Now, they think they'll get there. They don't think they'll get there on our watch.
Do you have any sense of just what the Bush administration has been doing to poll Iraqi opinion? Have they been doing the sort of things you've been?
I think the State Department does some polling of their own, but I'm not privy to it.
It doesn't seem like, well, the State Department, it's a question whether anybody else would read anything the State Department did within the Bush administration.
I know for a fact that they do some tracking, and generally I have to say that the CPA, for instance, their own website, has put up some of the polls that have been published both by ourselves and ABC and some of the other surveys that are out there. Those folks who are really in charge of trying to track sentiment and trying to understand how this looks from the other side have not shied away from that, or even putting these things on their own in their own releases and so on. But that, as you say, that's part of the political equation. It's not the whole political equation.
Now, there's some talk in this country that, especially coming out of the administration, that there's not broad support for, say, Sadr and his army. Can you get a sense of that sort of thing?
We didn't ask about him specifically. I've seen some other polling that is now out of date that would suggest that's true. That he, the issue that would be interesting to measure is whether or not he has been enhanced in stature by the fact that he's become a kind of poster person for resistance to the coalition. And we don't have a measurement on that. We had at one point attempted to measure the popularity of very specific figures in Iraq. And at the end, we simply measured the popularity or the favorability ratings towards Hussein, which were quite low, but so, not as specific figures.
So there's not much nostalgia for Saddam?
None. In the single digits range, 8, 10%. They give, you know, maybe 8% that give him a favorable rating. I'm pulling the number off of memory, but it's in the single digits. Most people think he was guilty of atrocities. Most people think he's going to be tried, and a majority in Iraq think he's probably going to be found guilty. And of those 60%, if he were found guilty, think he ought to face the death sentence. So it's not a question of people wanting that particular pass back.
And I think yesterday or today is his birthday.
So
67
right.
years old. But I guess we have to conclude on this sort of speculative note. But what do these results tell you about the future of the American occupation of Iraq? Do you think it's severely troubled?
Well, they want again some form of sovereignty. Hopefully, a fairly extensive form in their view is going to be handed over on the 30th. I think they want elections. They want them sooner rather than later. They want a regime that's accountable. And again, the positive note in this is a couple of things. One is that they do back this notion of a limited caretaker government until elections can be held, but they clearly want elections. And 5 years out, by a huge margin, I mean, you know, better than 2-1, they think the country's going to be better off. And they're optimistic about their personal future. So the question is, you know, it makes a big difference, frankly. For example, if the troops are there by invitation of a sovereign government, when you say should the troops go home, 57% say yes immediately, and only something in the mid 30s say no, they should stay longer. Even though they think they'll be safer if they stay, it's a question of sovereignty and it's a question of control. If you say if a new Iraqi government comes in and asks them to stay for a limited period of time, then suddenly it splits as to whether they should leave right away or not. So some of this has to do with self-determination.
And any questions about a UN versus US-led operation?
Not specifically about whether it should be UN-led or US-led. I would say that the UN has obviously a higher favorability rating than the US does in the country, although it's not as high as some folks think, because the UN is also seen as the entity under whose auspices the sanctions were imposed for a decade, which hurt the population far more than they hurt the regime. But it has a generally a far more positive rating than the U.S.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Doug, for having me.
Taking us out of time out of a busy schedule, Richard Burkholder, who is the director of Gallup's International Bureau and supervised their recent poll of Iraq. And the program is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. And now, continuing in this breathless pace, we're joined by Amy Liu, who is a novelist and whose book Flash House came out late last year in paperback, and lots of political content to it. So we're continuing our theme of mixing culture and politics. Welcome to WBAI, Amy Liu.
Thanks for having me, Deb.
So Flash House is a complicated and longish novel about starts in India, 1949. So give us a quick plot summary before we get to some specific questions.
Well, it weaves together a lot of different threads, including one storyline that has to do with the CIA's activities in Central Asia back in 1949, which was the precursor to their later involvement with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. That's one thread of the story involving a woman whose husband is implicated in the CIA activities, and he disappears into Central Asia. There's another storyline, however, that deals with sexual trafficking, which, of course, has always gone on in Central Asia and pretty much around the world, but especially in Central and South Asia. It's always been a very big source of income, actually, for a lot of people. And one of the threads in the book has to do with a young girl who is trafficked into prostitution and is quote-unquote rescued by an American, the same American, actually, whose husband disappears. So those two kind of competing stories are involved in the book.
And I hope you'll excuse me if I take off my literary critic's hat and do the political economy side of things here, but let's talk a bit about the CIA, first of all. What did you find? What were they up to in Central Asia in the late 1940s, early 1950s?
Well, 1949 was right after the CIA was formed, and one of the first places that they went was to Xinjiang province, which was between the Soviet Union and the coming communist force from eastern China. And the idea there was basically the same idea that later occurred in Vietnam, which was to create a third force of rebel tribes people who theoretically would hold back the communists. And they did in Central Asia what they subsequently have done many times around the world, which was to hook up with the biggest thugs that they could find. And
who were these particular thugs?
Well, one of them was a man whose name was Osman, very similar to Osama bin Laden in his kind of general prototype, and he was accused, he was actually took some pride in it, of having killed his nephew, his 12-year-old nephew, just as an indicator of his personality, because the nephew had been used as a messenger to bring him a message from one of his enemies. He was a guy who switched sides repeatedly, depending on his convenience, either against the communists and for the communists, either with the nationalist government or against the national government, and that he was an indicator of the kind of person that the CIA was hooking up with at that time. It was an idea that didn't pan out. As soon as the communists took over, of course, these tribal leaders that they CIA had been trying to form into a unit, they disbanded and they fled. But that was what they were doing. And in point of fact, the first CIA operative to die in the line of duty was a man named Douglas McKiernan, who was based at in what was then called Tiwa, which was the provincial capital in Xinjiang province. And he was running this whole operation and also running it as a listening post, because the Soviet Union was setting off nuclear weapons across the border, and he was monitoring that. He was the last person out of the consulate when the communists came in, and he burned all the papers in the consulate and then fled to the south through the same mountain passes that are described in my novel. And he ended up getting killed by Tibetan tribes people as he was trying to cross the mountains. But and he, by the way, his story has only just been released or brought out, actually, by investigators within the last couple of years. McKiernan was one of many CIA operatives who, you know, were covered up. Their deaths were not revealed or acknowledged by the CIA, which is one of the other threads in this story, because the story centers on the wife of a man who's drawn into CIA activities. And a lot of the story deals with how incredibly hard it is for the families of CIA operatives when their family members disappear or are killed, and the CIA very often gives them no assistance at all in terms of finding out what happened. So that's, you know, yet another thread to the story.
And since you already gave that away, I'm not spoiling any plot details by saying that his initial cover is he's kind of a bad boy, leftish journalist, very critical of the nationalist Chinese, right?
Right, and he is part Chinese, which is another... And as I started writing this book, of course, it was well before 9/11, and I had no idea that this whole tidal wave was coming down on us. But just by coincidence, I was writing about the McCarthy period. That this is a left-wing, lefty newspaper reporter who's basically drummed out of the United States by the McCarthy era because of his antagonism towards the nationalist Chinese, who were really had a stranglehold on Washington at the time. That it's not unlike the stranglehold that the Saudis have on Washington, you know, today. There are a lot of different parallels between what was going on then and what is going on today.
And another issue in the novel is, I should say, I'm speaking with Amy Liu, who is the author of the novel Flash House, published by...
Warner Books.
Warner Books, okay, yeah.
Out in paperback this year.
Out in paperback this year. It's they make their logo very hard to read on this on the cover of the book. another thread of the book is sexual trafficking, and you did some research in this field and discovered things that perhaps...
Right.
Might surprise some people. So
well, for openers, Flash House is a term for brothel, just in case anybody's wondering about that.
Is that Indian, or is that in broader use than that?
It actually dates back to Victorian period. And the early, what we now think of as brothels, were basically brought to India by the British during the colonial period when they were trying to keep their British troops happy away from home. So they created what we think of as the red light district in India. And the term came, you know, at this around the same time of Flash House. But in terms of the research that I did on this book, it became one of the core themes of the book is rescue and the idea of rescue and how complicated and how often we don't understand why we want to rescue people. We're not honest with ourselves, and we're not honest with the people that we're trying to rescue. And that became a theme both politically and socially and emotionally throughout the book on many different levels. But it came out of my initial research when I was a typical Western bleeding heart person reading stories in American magazines about these heroic rescue attempts to save young girls who had been trafficked into prostitution. And by the way, there are about 1 to 2 million girls who are trafficked into prostitution around the world each year, and almost 500,000 are trafficked into prostitution in South Asia alone every year. So this is a huge problem. And I came to it from, as I say, a typical Western perspective, thinking, oh, God, somebody's got to go in and rescue these girls. And I started to put this in my novel as a theme, the main character of the book is somebody who is in her bones a rescuer, and she's a social worker who is doing this work in India when the book opens. But in researching her position and in researching sexual trafficking and the red light districts, I went to India, I went into the red light districts, I talked to many, many social workers who are actually working with the girls and trying to run programs to help them. I also talked to a lot of feminists who have very different points of view on what should be done. And the thing that leapt out at me over and over and over again was that, at least on the surface, these girls don't want to be rescued. And I was astonished, and it took me took a long time. I kept coming back to this. I kept talking to people. I say, are you sure they didn't, you know, you pulled them out and they didn't want to go home, and they ended up going back into the red light districts after they'd been rescued? You know, how could this be? And, of course, it was a mark of my incredible Western naivete that I didn't look at the whole picture of the world in which these young women lived, quote-unquote, normally. I didn't look at the patriarchal system of society there, which basically treats women as trash. I didn't look at the fact that they, for the vast majority of them, come from the bottom caste of society, that they were almost all illiterate, that they weren't trained to work in any other respect, and I didn't fully take into account the fact that a quote-unquote fallen woman, a woman who has slept with anybody other than her husband in South Asia, is really the bottom of the barrel, and no one will take her back. Her family won't take her back. Her village won't take her back. So there's really nowhere else for her to go.
Now, do they perceive what they do as degrading in any way, or they just take it as all in a day's work?
They do see it as degrading, but it's, you know, that you also have to take into account the fatalism in South Asia. Once they're there, it's like going through a door that you know, that doesn't permit them to go backwards. And if a Westerner comes in, plucks them out, and sends them back to their village, the village doesn't want them back. They're really rejected. So yes, they feel incredibly degraded. It's not, I'm not trying to say that they enjoy this work at all, but I am saying that the programs that are working with these women, that as far as I can tell are really doing good work, are the ones that work with them one step at a time. They don't come in on the white horse, you know, the white knight kind of attitude that Americans tend to bring to these issues, and try to sweep them up and solve the problem in one great grand stroke. They are there on the ground in the red light districts working with the women to provide microfinancing, to provide help for their kids, to make sure that they get medical care, that kind of help, to give them the seeds of instruction so that they can actually, if they leave the red light district, whether by escape or by rescue, they actually have some tools to get on with their life in other ways. It's a much bigger and more complicated issue than our, you know, Western kind of women's magazine approach would tend to have. And it's analogous, really, to our going into Iraq and expecting everybody to, you know, wave the white flag and throw us kisses for doing it. It's a matter of, it's a mistake, I think, that Americans especially tend to make going out into the world and trying to affect change in other cultures. We have a very bad habit of not doing our homework before we go in, of not studying the way things are on the ground, of not looking at the situation from any other point of view but our own. We bring our own cultural assumptions and paste them on a situation and then are completely flummoxed when there's a backlash or when the consequences are not what we anticipate them to be. And that's happened with a lot of Western aid workers who go in and try to help prostitutes, sex workers, in especially South Asia. And as I say, the organizations that are the most successful seem to be the ones that are empowering from within. They're working directly on the ground with these women to give them tools to help them, you know, break their own chains rather than trying to do it for them.
All right. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Amy Liu is the author of the novel Flash House, and it's about sexual trafficking and CIA skullduggery in South Asia in the late 40s, early 50s, and it's just out in paperback from Warner Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. We'll stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with this selection from a something that's available on the web. It's a remix, a whole bunch of remixes of songs from The Clash's London Calling. It's called London Booted. Remixes of all the tracks on that album, plus some bonuses. And you can find it on the web. Just Google the words London Booted, B-O-O-T-E-D, London Booted. This is a remix by Instamatic of Spanish Bombs mixed up with Outkast's Bombs in Baghdad. So let's listen to a bit of that.
Yeah, in slum, national, underground, thunder pounds when I stomp the ground. Like a million elephants, a silverback, orangutans, you can't stop a train. Who wants some, don't come unprepared, I'll be there. But when I leave there, better be a household name. Weatherman telling us it ain't gonna rain. So now we sitting in a drop top soaking wet. In the silk suit trying not to sweat. Hitting somersaults without the net. But this be the year that we won't forget. 1999, Alabama, anything goes. Be what you wanna be, long as you know consequences. The giving for living, the fences. Too hot to jump in jail, too low to dig, I might just touch hell. Get a life, not on sale. Then I might catch you a spell. Look at what came in the mail. I'm scared as arm and hammer. So go grill and a baby mama. Black cat lacking a pack of pampers. Stack of questions with no answers. Cure for cancer, cure for AIDS. Make a nigga wanna stay on tour for days. Get back home, things are wrong. When I really it was bad all along. Before you left, ass up to a ball of power. Thoughts at 1,000 miles per hour. Hello ghetto, let your brain breathe. Believe there's always more. Don't pull the bang out unless you plan to bang. The bang, unless you plan to hit the thing.
Spanish bombs rock the province. I'm hearing music from another time. Spanish bombs cause the problem. I'm dying in on a DC 10 tonight.
Spanish bombs,
you have to kill me Benito. Just to quit her. Oh my god, I'm done.
Spanish bombs,
you have to kill me Benito.
Uno, dos, trace, it's on. Did you ever think of him rock a microphone like that? There, boy, we still stay street. Big things happen every time we meet. Like a track team, crack team, dying the geek. Outcast bumping up and down the street. Slam back, Cadillac, bye-bye, nigga, D75, MC, screech, dying to the beat. Cause we get crunk, stay drunk at the club. Should've bought an ounce, but you caught the dub. Should've held back, but you stole the punch. Supposed to beat you good, but you packed the lunch. No D to the U, to the G for you. Got a son on the way by the name of Bamboo. Got a little baby girl for a year, Jordan. Never turn my back on my kids, but